Mr. Heron, reel 4. Now, you were just describing how you were pulled out when the tape flipped off. If you could just finish describing that.
Yes. Well, as we swam to the side of the trawlers, they put fenders over the side on ropes, and it was to make it easier for us to hang on to something on the side of the ship as of the trawler, I mean, that they could help us aboard individually in at times. I remember then getting out of the water. We were very cold, no clothes on, so they wrapped these buntings around us that I mentioned. And then brought us ashore in Margate, whereas
Did there anything else other than wrap you up, or was there nothing?
There was nothing else to do. They wrap us up in their flags. And I remember looking a rather bedraggled mob on Margate Pier, where they dropped us off.
That was where you landed, Margate Pier?
At Margate Pier, yeah.
And what state were you in?
Exhausted, filthy, covered in this diesel oil, some of it had swallowed, so your stomach was pretty upset. Tired, but jubilant that we were actually on shore. And apart from that, I can't remember any of my reactions. Looking forward to a fortnight survivor's leave.
Now, tell me about what happened next then.
Well, the next thing we were in, I can't remember where it was, somewhere in Margate. We were given showers and cleaned up and generally equipped with new uniforms. I think we were equipped with civilian gear, I think. But I can't remember that what happened as far as the getting dressed again. And then we were overnight for the rest of the night, and during the next day, we were just being sort of cosseted and then put on the train back to Chatham. We went straight home. I went straight home to London.
And what do you remember about your survivor's leave? Because I believe that's where you met somebody quite famous, so Violet Zabo.
Violet Zabo.
Zabo,
yeah.
Yes.
Yes,
well, but tell us about your survivor's leave anyway.
How I went on in that?
Yes, how you've...
Well, as I, from the age of 16, I'd always been a dancer, ballroom dancer and that, because I always fancied it as the best place to pick up the women. And so it proved. I mean, it was a great pastime. I danced all the rest of my life. And quite fit, and instead of going to the pubs, although I used to have a session with the pubs at times, but I always found that a bit of waste of time. So we used to go to a place called the Streatham Locarno, which was one of these enormous dance halls they had in those days, where they had 10-piece band and several hundred dancers. It was a really big social thing, and it was on every night, and two or three afternoons a week. And so as soon as I got home and had chats with the parents, the usual sort of homecoming, then I'd shoot off to the Locarno Streatham to see what women were available. So
What sort of music was it there? I mean, was a typical night at the Streatham Locarno like from when you got there?
Oh, right. Well, of course, we were all dug up to the nines. And there was a balcony overlooking a big, big hall. I mean, I should think it would have, there would be at any one time at least 100 or 150 people on the floor dancing at any one time, and another 150 or more on the balconies, at the bars, and the food counters. There was everything there. A large 10-piece band. I can't remember the name of the guys, but they played the 40s music, somewhat of the style of, subsequently, of course, the Glenn Miller that type of thing. And there was, like, I remember this slightly, no, I think that was on, no, it wasn't on at that time. It was the English Savoy Hill something or other, I can't remember the full name, the Savoy Hill Band. There were lots of these big bands then in those days. It was the big band era. And you'd just go around and view all the females around the floor and sort of go and ask them to dance.
That was the etiquette, was it?
That was the etiquette, yes. You always went round and asked them to dance. They didn't ask you to dance. But
where would they be waiting for a dance? You know, would they be in the bar or...?
Oh, no, no. They'd go up for their coffee, but mostly they were sitting with expectant looks on their faces to see if they were getting a good break or not. And... it was amazing social, because you could literally, I mean, I used to go in the afternoon and I'd go out with a girl at the end of the afternoon session and say goodbye to her and go back in the evening session. So, I mean, there was, and it was during that time, of course, that I met Violet Szabo. Now, I must qualify this because I am not sure. I had two survivors lead about 6 months apart, and it was one of those two where I met Violet Szabo.
Well, let's take it on this one, you know, and we'll leave that qualification and the historians can sort out for themselves perhaps which one it was.
Yes, okay.
So how did you meet her?
Well, I was dancing. I went up to Austin for a dance, and we sort of clicked, you know. We got along well. I didn't know at the time, but she was a sales girl in Brixton, lived in Brixton. But she had she wasn't living with her parents at that time. She had a separate. Now, she was married, whether at this time or subsequently, I don't know. She may have been single at this time. No, she must have been married, because she was using the Szabo name, and that was her husband's name, who was a French army captain, who was killed at some time during the period, either before or after I knew her. And we stayed together for about a couple of weeks, two or three weeks. Then she went, disappeared.
Was it a full-on affair, a sexual affair?
Oh, yes, it was a full affair, yeah. I think a lot of those were in those days. You know, you were thinking, well, I might not be... Well, that was your excuse, anyway. Whether it was... You really believed it or not, I don't know. I can't say I always did. It was just an excuse for jumping into bed as quickly as possible.
Now, what kind of a woman was she then? Because, I mean, she had these amazing things that happened to her later on. But at the time, how did she strike? Did she stand out, if you see what I mean, in any way? Or
she was a very good dancer. I remember she was a good dancer. She was very attractive. I didn't really knew she spoke French. She spoke with a slight Cockney accent, in fact, very slight, but a Cockney accent. And apart from that, I can't remember all that much we talked about. Not that we talked very much. We were either dancing or in bed, I think it was the
Well, you remember her name, though, but... Would you remember the names of the other ones you met at the time? That's what I mean. She seems to have stood out in your memory.
Well, no, because, you see, I didn't know. I remember her name. Obviously, I remembered her name. It wasn't a question of her standing out. What it was, I saw subsequently the movie called Carved Her Name with Pride. And, of course, immediately it struck me that must have been her. I mean, it wasn't any other way. And then I read the book. This was years and years ago. And I saw that she was a sales girl in Brixton. She lived in Brixton. She danced. She's a very keen dancer. She danced at the Streatham Lacana. And it couldn't have been anybody. There weren't more than... It's the sort of Szabo name doesn't...
And you had remembered the name.
I'd remembered the name, and that's what immediately clicked.
Anything else about her you recall?
About her?
Yeah. Oh, just before we move on.
No, not really. You know, these transitory affairs, you know, didn't make much impression because you were off again.
What caused you to split up, if split up's the right word?
Well, no, she, you know, we were coming, we made appointments. I think I made a date with her to go to the Locarno on a particular date. She didn't turn up.
Were you going out with other women at the same time, and was she going out with other men at the same time, in your opinion, or...?
No, I don't think so. It was only, don't forget, it was only a matter of 2 or 3 weeks that we were together. And we were there pretty at the Locarno pretty well every day. Although, I don't think she could have been working... No, that was evenings, of course, so no, sometimes the matinees, but... No.
But you were only seeing her?
I was only seeing her during that period.
So it was a sort of brief, fairly intense...
The brief encounter.
Anything else about your leave? Or was that would just about fill a leave, actually?
Yeah, it was. It was only that 2 weeks.
But how were you... Had you had any after effects from being so? Because sometimes people can have problems.
None at all. I was too thick to be.
So what happened next then?
Well, I went back from leave and almost back to Chatham. Oh, I had some funny incidents in Chatham, I must tell you.
Tell me about that.
During this period. There was a great deal of... We never had enough money, of course. That was the big problem, to go anywhere. And we used to save it up for a few highlights like the Locarno. So what we used to do was to hitchhike up from Chatham up to London. And we had some really funny incidents. One classic one was... we were standing at the main road up to London, and it was on the rise of a hill. And this lorry came along and slowed down for us, but didn't stop. And we all took off to jump on. It was a flatboard lorry, and we all ran like hell and threw our gear on. But by the time I'd got hold of the lorry to jump on board, it was accelerating up the hill. And I ran almost all the way up the hill on the back of this lorry, holding on like grim death. And eventually the guys pulled me on board. But we used to have funny things. I went up on motorbikes and all sorts of weird transport between Chatham and London.
Anything else during that time?
No.
The first bomb. What do you remember the first bomb? I mean, it may not have been this time, but it almost certainly was.
It was, yes.
What do you remember the...
Well, I remember very distinctly because we were still in that era of the... hammocks strung all the way along it was still in that situation. And it was during that time, and the bomb went, that I think it was that brought about this panic station that I mentioned earlier, when we were running along underneath the hammocks, because we were going to, the alarm was for that when they dropped that bomb at Chatham. And so although the two periods were almost identical, it was this period when the bomb was dropped in Chatham. There was a big panic stations. Everybody had to rush down to the shelters. But most of us never got there because we were still milling around in this massive mess deck.
And... Where did the bomb drop anywhere near you? I mean, or
no,
did you go and see what had happened?
I think it was only one or two bombs at the most, and it was miles away down at Chatham. But as nobody had ever experienced bombing before. They, you know, there was panic stations over what was virtually nothing, or very little.
Anything else about your time at Chatham? That second
Not
time?
Really, no. I think those the times at Chatham have all merged into one blur, as far as I'm concerned.
That's reasonable. And what was your next posting? This was around about October, November. We're not quite sure, but...
Yes, that's true, and I'm not too sure. That was to the Keith at Dover, and... there was nothing particularly sticks in my mind about the sticks in my mind about that trip down to Dover, or even arriving in Dover, because I'd been there a few times before, of course, with the during the first posting.
Now, what type of a ship was the Keith?
The Keith was slightly bigger than the Blanche. It was the flotilla leader for the B boats, and was complement was about 180 officers and men, and was larger, still 4.7s guns, had a bit more smaller anti-aircraft equipment. The office, the wireless office, was a bit bigger.
Same equipment?
No, it was, if I remember rightly, it was in fact into a more advanced equipment from the Blanche. Better and more advanced.
What sort of advances were being made? Do you see what I mean? What improvements were being achieved at this time?
Well, in the electronics field.
Yeah, but what effect did it have? Do you see what you mean?
Yes. Well, it didn't have a lot of effect, because after all, there were two basic things. One is you had to transmit, one is you had to receive, and the third thing, you had to disseminate it sometimes. The flotilla leader would disseminate the information round the flotilla, or part of the flotilla that we were operating with. And that equipment, in this case, was an improvement in that it wasn't the old spark transmitter as it was in the Blanche. It was a normal valve-type transmitter, a little bit more powerful, and also there was a, if I remember correctly, a VHF equipment for inter-ship communications within the flotilla. Apart from that, the mess deck, apart from minor situations in the ship itself, the layout was similar, and the way we ran the canteen messing and everything was also the same, and the way everything was done. In the Naffy was a bit bigger, I remember that, and we had a better selection of food from Naffy. The only thing that I did abhor was the fact that when we were at sea a lot and we weren't getting any fresh milk, drinking condensed milk in tea, and it put me off tea for the rest of my life. You know, when the spoon used to stand up vertically in the cup in the tea, with this sticky, gungy, sweet, oversweet stuff they stuck it, condensed milk. Anyway, that was one. But apart from that, again, where food was pretty... In fact, I think we fed better than the civilian population. At times, I mean, obviously there were rough times during the war generally, but on the whole, we fed better.
So what would you get? What sort of food would you get?
Well, we always had... I mean, it was one massive fry-up, so that was the most possible. I mean, it probably didn't do us any good, but we were so damn fit from our training days that you could literally go through anything without suffering overdue amount of...
So what kind of thing for breakfast, then?
Well, you would have sausage, egg... This, don't forget, it's canteen messing, so it depended a great deal, one, on the cook, two, on the money you had available, and three, whether there was any particular... problems with regard to diets, or anybody didn't like this, that, or that. I can never remember any of the Matlows wanting to do anything else but eat all that was available.
So a fry-up for breakfast. What sort of thing would you have for lunch, dinner?
Lunch was, well, we always had a main course. A lot of them were roast beef, the usual roast beef, veg and potatoes, which was generous in that. Well, then... It hadn't hit the civilian population at that time, I think. It was still pretty good. But anyway, that was... And then we usually finished up with something like Spotted Dick or Treacle Pudding or anything that would satisfy the hunger of young guys, you know. We, not that we particularly, as telegraphists, were very energetic. I mean, we were sat in the office for hours on end.
I'll come to that. What about tea or evening meal?
Tea, we didn't normally do anything very much about it. It's not the accepted 4 o'clock for tea type of thing. It was mainly at supper at night where we'd have, it would be we had some fish, and there was a fair mixture. I can't remember the evening meal quite so much. It was not an important. The big meal was the lunchtime.
Now, what was your basic routine like on the ship? Because you didn't have much of a time to establish a routine on the Blanche because it went down. But
exactly.
Were you on the Dover patrol? Well, Channel patrolling.
Yes.
And what was a typical patrol like? Take me through it. From leaving Dover.
Well, a lot would depend on the weather, of course, whether you had a comfortable trip or not. As I said, the two periods, both on the Blanche and the Keith, merge very much. Again, you had this mine business. It was happening all the time because the British mines would perhaps lose their wire support and come floating to the surface and bang along the ship. But apart from that, it was very much, I think, the most difficult thing was, of course, getting up to do your watch. And the 4 hours and four hours on and 4 hours off watch keeping, because even at the time you still had to do your cooking in the mess, so 4 hours off didn't really give you any sleep, or at least one period of four didn't. So I'm trying to work out, I can't remember exactly how long it was the sort of thing that would happen. You'd do a midnight watch, say, from, I can't remember now, it was Seven Bells or something, you know, the old nautical terms. Those have gone over the years. But we started with a four-hour period at night, and then we'd have an early start we'd get some sleep then until breakfast time, snatch an hour or two to breakfast time. Then you'd go on again and watch in the forenoon, and then you'd have become off watch, you'd have for your lunch or dinner as it was then, and then you'd go back on watch in the afternoon. And so it went on like that. Every 4 hours you would up on watch, back down below, snatching in between meals, snatching sleep. There was never any, you could never get 8 hours sleep at a stretch, except when you were in harbour.
How did that affect you?
I think we used to get a bit disgruntled with everything. I mean, the lack of sleep is probably the worst thing, particularly for youngsters of that age. You need your 8 hours, but you never get it, of course. And if anything else is happening, which happened later, if anything else is happening, you're automatically taken off that your four-hour sleeping period to do whatever's necessary. And of course, when you're in action, that's what happens. You don't get any sleep at all.
Now, if you know. How long would you be out for on a typical patrol?
I think, if I remember rightly, about 48 hours. A bit longer than that. Maybe 3 days. You'd be out for 2 or 3 days.
Do you remember anything in particular happening?
No, it was a very dull period, that. I mean, there was nothing happening. There was one incident I remember in Dover when we were actually lying alongside. When we weren't alongside, we were anchored in midstream, and one of the ships was cleaning the Beaufors, and that somehow or other some idiot had knocked the safety catch off and opened fire. And it happened that on another destroyer there was a gang of guys pulling the pulling up the boat, you know, the up onto its davits, and apparently somebody was killed. I don't know the full length of the story, but I happened to have noticed that because I was up on deck. But that was a bit of a startling opera.
That wasn't on your ship, though.
No, it wasn't. Nothing to do with us, no. It was one of the B boats, but I can't remember which one.
What would you do in, you know, in, when you were in harbour? How long would you be in harbour for, and what would you do?
Well, I don't think we went ashore very much. Mostly, we got what sleep we could. You know, we caught up on our sleep during the time we were in. We'd go ashore occasionally.
What would you do ashore?
Well, mostly go to the... at that time, I was a pub guy, and I used to go with the rest of the mob to the local pub and have a few drinks. And
what was the atmosphere like in a Dover pub? I mean, because...
It was pretty riotous at times, because, you know, you're letting steam off, virtually. That's what it was. I mean, just sinking a few pints and doing stupid things.
What kind of stupid things?
Oh, God, I can't remember. I really can't. I was not a great pub man. I never really enjoyed. I did it because I wanted to be a big sailor with the rest of the boys, you know. And it. But I was never much of a pub man. I didn't enjoy drinking. I hadn't got the capacity for it, and I didn't enjoy it that much. And being of Scots descent, I suppose I was pretty careful with my bourbies. So,
I tell. How much did the others drink, though? I mean, the chaps you were with.
I mean, anything like 6, 7, 8 pints a night. I couldn't believe it most of the time. I mean, you'd see them sinking this stuff pint after pint. When all I could do is... my limit was about 2 or 3 pints. That was the absolute limit. Other than that, I'd have been sick with the sheer volume of water slushing around in the bowels. You know.
How did they react to the drink? I mean,
there were fights and things. So that reminds me. I really must mention. No, that comes later.
Would you get caught up in fight? I mean, if someone in your group got into a fight.
Oh, I think we would have done, but it never happened. I don't think our group. You see, mostly I was with the other guys, the other telegraphists. And we weren't such a riotous mob, really. We were more seriously minded, I suppose.
How did the telegraphists get on? I mean, did they have a special status? Because they were meant to be more intelligent.
They were supposed to be. I'm not sure that we were, but... we were supposed.
How did you fit in within the ship? Because normally, you know, you've got the sailors and you've got the stokers.
Yeah. Right.
And then there's a sort of telegraphist.
It became individual once. I mean, as a bunch of telegraphists, we're working together. We're mostly on the same mass. And so we became friends within our own group. But also we made individual friendships within the crew.
Did they look up or down to you? Because just because you were bright doesn't mean they look up to you.
No, not at all. I don't think there was ever any... I don't think during my wartime experiences that I ever found any sort of... stoker was always considered to be... the stokers and the... were always slightly inferior. I think they were looked on as such. I don't think it was fair, but I mean, nevertheless... The stokers and the seamen, second class, the lowest form of animal life in the Navy. But no, I think there was a certain degree of snobbishness in it. But, you know, it wasn't justified. And I don't think it really was of any consequence, really. I mean, we still made friends amongst stokers and seamen or whatever.
Was there any bullying aboard the ship at all?
No, there was a lot of course, the jaunty, as he's called, the master at arms, was the overall pinnacle of power on the lower deck.